Hi, my name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I want to welcome you to today's webinar titled The CFPB's No Action Letter and Sandbox Policy, Opportunities for the ARM Industry. The CFPB has made some announcements recently that may have gotten lost in the holiday shuffle, and we're fortunate to have Joanne Needleman here today from Clark Hill to walk us through the details of those announcements and what they mean for the ARM industry. I want to take a quick second and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use, and it's a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Let me tell you a little bit about today's speaker. Joanne Needleman is leader of the Consumer Financial Services Regulatory Compliance Group at Clark Hill, serving as a navigator to her clients seeking advice and guidance in the complex regulatory environment facing the financial services industry. She provides counsel, consultation, and litigation services to a wide array of financial institutions, law firms, credit reporting agencies, as well as venture capital firms looking to invest in the fintech space. A former member of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's Consumer Advisory Board, and the immediate past president of the board of directors of the National Creditors Bar Association, or NARCA, Joanne has been able to provide her clients with useful strategies in order to prepare for new areas of regulatory scrutiny. The format for today's webinar will be a presentation from Joanne. We encourage everybody to submit questions, and we'll get to them when the presentation has concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded, and a recording will be made available in the coming days on AccountsRecovery.net. Finally, there is a presentation, so you should see the title page for today's webinar on your screen. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Joanne. I think we're ready to go. Joanne, why don't you take it away?
Well, thank you, Mike, and thank you to all who joined this afternoon. Happy New Year. I appreciate you spending an hour with us today to talk about, I think, are some new and exciting opportunities that the Bureau is putting forth when it comes to innovation and regulation. Next slide, Mike. Just quick disclaimer, I am not your attorney. I am not giving you legal advice, although I'm certainly happy to change that that paradigm if necessary. But just understand that this is informational only and not legal advice. Next slide, please. So what we want to talk about today has been what is, I call, a decade-old dilemma of innovation versus regulation. We all know that innovation is outpacing regulation and has been doing that for some time. The prior Bureau administration, while they considered it, did not do much in trying to foster innovation that was coming on fast and furious with their current priorities for consumer protection and regulation. And so what has happened in certainly the last year is the Bureau has put forth some policies, which I'm going to go over with you today. I'm going to tell you in advance, this is a bit dense. I'm going to try to do my best to kind of give a 10,000-foot overview of what these policies are trying to do and the substance of these policies. We're also going to talk a little bit about what opportunities there are for the ARM industry. I think there's some, but there are some pitfalls, and we need to look at them very carefully. I will also tell you that as far as the no action letter and the sandbox policy, those right now are out for comment, meaning those policies have been published in the Federal Register. I would encourage anybody, it doesn't matter who you are, it doesn't matter if you belong to an association or not, although I know some associations will be submitting comments. Comments are so important because they develop the administrative record. And as we start to go through this presentation, I might, you know, give you some ideas of where you might want to comment. I'm not saying that you have to do it, but understand that the consumer advocates are absolutely going to comment on these proposals because overall they have, you know, the advocates have not been favorable of what the CFPB is doing. They think it's too much of a rollback of regulation and that consumers will be harmed. I think that there's probably a place in the middle for both sides. So I think it's important that if you do have something to say, say it. You're not graded on it. You know, nothing's going to happen. It just will be part of the record. All right, next slide, please. So here's what we're going to talk about today. going to talk a little bit briefly. I'll try to do this all briefly. As I said, pretty dense and we only have an hour. I'm going to talk about the prior CFPB policies regarding no action letters. I'm going to introduce you to the Office of Innovation, and that is going to be the main office that's going to deal with these proposals. I'm going to talk about the new no action letter and sandbox policies specifically, where the opportunities are for the ARM industry. What we still don't know, those are the wild cards or the pitfalls that I think that we need to be aware of and consider as we move through and consider these policies. The trial disclosure program, it's a little bit confusing. So I'm going to talk about, there has been a trial disclosure program. I'm going to talk about that it was not successful. But that proposal has already been put out and comments have already been submitted. So that's out there as well. And I want to talk about that and tell you a little bit of the differences and how we incorporate that into some of these proposals. And then finally, I want to talk about engaging the Bureau, because that's going to be very important if you're considering whether you're a company, association, whomever, if you have an idea or a product, a way to do a financial product or service differently, and you want to get into the Bureau and talk to them, I want to give you some tips on what that might look like. Next slide. All right, so let's talk about what the prior Bureau administration did or in fact did not do when it came to no action letters. Next slide. So as we all know, under Title 10 of the Dodd-Frank Act, which was the creation of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and by the way, we're back to the CFPB now. The new director has said that we're not going to call it the BCFP. So we're back to the CFPB or the Bureau. They have certain authorities over certain enumerated consumer protection laws. We all know what those laws are. And under that authority, they can do things to promote the purpose and objectives. And the purpose and objectives, as we know, is to protect consumers, but also to make markets more transparent, make consumers understand those markets so that they have a better choice of the products and services that they want to use. Now, we all think of the Bureau as an agency that does enforcement and supervision, but they also have authorities to not enforce or to not supervise. And that's a little bit of where we're going with these no action letters and sandboxes. It's a way to get into the Bureau and say, we know that you can do these things, but we're asking you not to do this under specific circumstances. And they do have discretion there. Now, the no action policy, which is permitted under the statute, was proposed in 2014 and finalized in 2016. And in order to do that, the Bureau developed what was called Project Catalyst. Now, Project Catalyst was a little division within a Bureau. If you follow the Bureau, you will know that it wasn't anywhere on a prior org chart. It was just kind of this group that was run by a senior policy advisor, Dan Kwan, who reported directly to Richard Cordray. But it wasn't like the Office of Regulation or a specific division that was devoted to a market, like the debt collection markets team. It was just kind of this group that was there that was supposed to look at fintech and innovative things. The problem was it was an outlier. It wasn't affiliated with any other division. And it had, three or four people in it. And so it wasn't very robust. And in fact, it only approved one no action letter in the years of its existence, and that was to a company called Upstart Network, which was an online lender. So the Bureau has been very slow to adopt its no action policy. So you understand, other agencies already, the idea of a no action letter or no action policy is not new. Many other federal agencies have that and have implemented that for years. Unfortunately, the Bureau was very slow to adopt it. Next slide. So what is a no action letter? It's basically a document from an agency provided to an entity based on particular facts and circumstances. And to those entities in which the Bureau has, supervision or enforcement authority over it, but basically exercising some discretion over that conduct. And it's basically saying, you're going to act in good faith and you're going to comply with what you said you were going to do, whether you give the product or there's a certain service, and the Bureau will not make any supervisory findings or bring any enforcement actions, including UDAP claim, potential UDAP claims, or any other authority that they may have under a statute or regulatory authority. I'd like to say that a no action letter is basically a note from your mother saying you're going to be good and you can be excused from recess. That's the simplistic way of saying what a no action letter is. Next slide. So some of the highlights of the prior no action policy, I think first and foremost, and I think one of the reasons that industry was very hesitant to get involved is that there was data sharing. And not only was there data sharing, it was very kind of elusive of what that data sharing was going to be. It was also, the approval process was very discretionary in Project Catalyst. The application did not go up a food chain. It was kind of, you were working with this small group and, you know, they decided whether they were going to, you know, whether it was worth it or not to do this. So it was not, there was really no formal structure. And more importantly, even if they did a no action letter, it was not binding on the Bureau, the courts, or any other actors who may challenge the product or service that you were looking to do. It was a very limited duration, and the timetable for approval was determined on a case-by-case basis. So, you know, you could go in and 6 months later, you still may not have an approval. So it left a lot of companies in limbo. The Bureau was willing to consult with other regulators, but there was no policy of whether other state or federal regulators were bound by the no action letter. It was subject to modification and revocation, but only upon staff discretion. So you could be within doing a testing or whatever, and one day somebody could wake up and say, well, I think it should be different, or it could be revoked. So there's not a lot of due process there. You could request confidential information, but there was no discussion about FOIA. And when you're doing data sharing, you know, obviously anybody can FOIA the Bureau, and your data could be not only within the Bureau, but it could be given to somebody else. Next slide. Had a very onerous application process. There were 15 questions with subparts that a applicant had to answer. And I've highlighted two of them. You know, besides the basic information of what you want to do, there was a lot of discussion and explanation of why you wanted this waiver. And basically, a showing of why the substantial regulatory uncertainty is the subject of the request cannot effectively be addressed through other means, such as a modification of a product. So doesn't give a lot of incentive to want to go and do a no action letter, where basically they're saying is, you know, we really don't want to give it to you. Can't you modify your product or service? So again, not a lot of incentive. And then you had to describe the data that you were going to collect. And then there was always the possibility that the Bureau would want additional data. Very limited protection on proprietary information. And again, more importantly, besides all the other issues that I've addressed here, you know, the Bureau was not 100% guaranteeing that you weren't going to be enforced or supervised. There was no guarantee that a UDAP claim could be brought. It said it would be unlikely. Well, that doesn't give me a lot of confidence. The Bureau would make a statement that there would be no present enforcement action, but there would be continued supervision to ensure compliance with the no action letter. So, you know, just not a lot of comfort, which again supports why only one no action letter was given. Next slide. So based on the lack of success of Project Catalyst and their no action policy, when Acting Director Mulvaney came in November of 2017, obviously he made a lot of changes. And one of the most significant changes he made in the summer of last summer was developing the Office of Innovation. Next slide. And I just have here some quotes. I'm not going to read all of them, but clearly Mulvaney's priorities were to encourage innovation, especially consumer-friendly innovation. He merged Project Catalyst into this new Office of Innovation, and as I said, really made it a priority for Bureau to really look at this and see how to incorporate innovation into their regulatory scheme. And his first act in doing that was to hire Paul Watkins. Who was Paul Watkins? Paul Watkins worked for the Arizona Attorney General's office, and he was the person who developed the Arizona FinTech Regulatory Sandbox. So that was the first state to have what we call a sandbox. And I'll explain that, what it, an actual sandbox is. But if, for those in the financial services industry, you all may be familiar with the UK sandbox, which has been developed for the last, I think, 3 to 5 years. And it has been very successful in testing new and innovative fintech products in a very limited way with reduced regulatory burden. And Arizona was the first state to do this, which I think was very smart, because obviously you have a lot of fintech in California. They wanted to encourage people to come from California to Arizona. That's still in a development process. I think their application is not completely out yet. I'm not 100% sure. But he was really the visionary and the one who developed the sandbox. So it really made sense to bring Paul Watkins in and put him in a more federal position and a more national position. So he's running the Office of Innovation. Let me just also point out that he is an assistant director, unlike Project Catalyst, which really had no director. So he is the guy that's running the office. And the Office of Innovation, if you look at a CFPB org chart, falls under the Principal Policy Director's office, who is Brian Johnson, who's really the number two in command at the Bureau. So you really have an infrastructure there, which I think is important and gives some confidence to entities that want to come and engage the Bureau. And I just want to point out that we know we have a new director of the Bureau, Kathleen Croninger, or Kathy as she likes to be called. And she's committed to the Office of Innovation as well. She's put out several press releases, but in one that she put out right before the end of the year, you know, she talked about, you know, the goals of the Bureau, including making sure that the marketplace is innovating in ways to enhance consumer choice and the needs of the consumer. So it's not a fleeting idea, and the Office of Innovation is here to stay. Next slide, please. So what is the new no action letter and sandbox policy? What does it look like? Next slide. So like anything from an agency, there is a proposal. It's not necessarily a rule, but this is a proposed policy that has been put out there for comment. So it was published in the Federal Registry on December 13th. And it was one of Mick Mulvaney's final acts. And as I talked about comments, if you want to submit comments, they are due February 11th of this year. So what are the highlights of at least the no action policy? Next slide. Well, first and foremost, there is no data sharing when it comes to the no action policy. That's really important because obviously that was something that many entities were scared about in coming to do this. And wanting to do this. The authorization, you know, the approvals come through the actual, as I said, the office has an infrastructure. It's part of the policy director's office. So the assistant director of, we're going to call it OOI, that person is going to be the one who approves it. So there's going to be some sort of formal structure. It is most importantly binding on the Bureau. So if the Office of Innovation approves an application for what we're going to call it an NAL, the rest of the Bureau, including enforcement and supervision, are bound by that. They can take no action. The application process, the way it's written says there's no temporal limitations, meaning, you know, there's no time limit of how long you can have this no action letter. But I do not believe that it'll be in perpetuity, and I think that's going to be a big issue for the advocates, and I think there's going to be a lot of comments on that. Again, I think that just feeds into the, you know, reduction of regulatory burden and consumers are going to be harmed. So I think that's an issue we have to look at very carefully. But the approval process will take 60 days. So once you put your application in, you will know whether your application has been granted or denied within 60 days, which is, you know, if you're a company, you always need that consistency and you need it, and you need the speed of that consistency. The Bureau wants coordination with other state and federal regulators, and I think that's very important. The application is very simplified. So we went from 15 questions with subparts to 7. You know, basic information. And the key question that needs to be answered in the application is, what is the uncertainty or ambiguity or barrier that the relief would address, that the no action policy would address? So I think that's important because we know we all hit brick walls when we're trying to comply and we say, wow, things could be different. You know, that if we could get some relief or some guidance on doing something a little bit different, I would like to go down that path. I will tell you, In the past year, many of the trade associations have been going into the Bureau, especially with this new administration, and ask for what we call quick fixes. And, you know, if we could rewrite rules, how could we write them better? This could be, this no action policy could be a perfect example. You know, can we have a barcode now? That would be a perfect example. And can we have some relief about testing barcodes to make sure that consumers are not confused or we're not otherwise doing inappropriate debt collection? These are very rough and crude examples, but hopefully this gives you an idea of what the Bureau is looking for. You can request confidential information, and you can also request exemptions under FOIA. I think that's really important. Even though there's no data sharing here, there could be FOIA requests of your application. There could be FOIA requests about other information if you're looking for a no action letter. So there is some FOIA protection. Next slide, please. There is better protection for proprietary information, which is obviously very important for companies. There is protection from UDAC claims, which is, again, why would you go down this path if you didn't have that protection? And the revocation and modification requirements are a little bit more formal. So if the Bureau thinks that the no action letter should be modified or they think that you're not complying, you have an opportunity to respond. So there's some due process considerations, which were not there before. It also may cover third parties. That may be helpful if you're interested in going to the Bureau and maybe working with another vendor. That vendor could get some protections as well. And as I said before, it's binding on other parts of the Bureau regarding enforcement or supervision activities. But I also want to point out, and this was in the other proposals as well, but it's continued here, and it, my sense is that it's going to have a little bit more teeth to it. If your application is denied, that denial may be published. And so companies really need to think about that when they're applying. I mean, you obviously want to be accepted, but the consequence of not being accepted may be important to a particular entity or trade association. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes. Next slide, please. So the second proposal that came out in addition to the no action letter was, they call it the BCFP sandbox. I guarantee you when the final proposal comes out, it'll say CFPB. But what is a sandbox? We talk about it, and I've talked about it throughout this webinar, but just want to make sure you understand what it is. So Mick Mulvaney did a quote back in June. A regulatory sandbox is generally a program that allows companies to offer products and services in a limited way under a modified regulatory regime while providing information on the experiment of their regulator. So while a no action letter really talks about doing something in a different way and getting some protection, the sandbox is really about it, something completely new and different, a new product, a new way of doing things that is a little bit more robust. And there may be some startup companies or existing companies that want to test products, and a sandbox may be a good opportunity to do that. Next slide, please. However, sandbox is a little different. And I want to explain those differences. I think the first and most important difference is there is data sharing. The Bureau fully expects that you're going to become partners with them. And you're going to work on this new product or this new idea. And they really want to know, you know, what that's all going to mean and the data that you're going to collect. So if you know, that's something that's not comfortable with an entity, then I would not do a sandbox. But there is going to be data sharing. And you're going to basically enter into a contract. It's going to have terms and conditions. You're going to do X, Y, and Z. The Bureau is going to expect X, Y, and Z from you, and you've got to live up to that contract. Again, there's an approval process through the assistant director. It's not ad hoc, so there is a formal structure there. Unlike the no action letter, it's binding on the Bureau, but in certain circumstances, it may be binding on other parties, meaning it may provide you with an exemption to private right of action, which obviously is something very important that the arm industry would be very agreeable to. But we'll talk about that in a minute, but there is some opportunities there. Your partnership or your experiment with the Bureau has a two-year limit, but it can be extended. Again, a 60-day approval process, coordination with other regulators. a modified application similar to the no action application, no action letter application. Again, you have to identify the uncertainty or ambiguity of, you know, why you want to go into this partnership or what this product or service will do, but also a description of data, of what the data you're going to collect and what you're going to share with the Bureau, and opportunities if the Bureau wants different data that you're going to do that. So keep that in mind. Next slide. Like the no action letter, you can request confidential treatment. You can request exemptions from FOIA. It will protect your proprietary information. Again, protection from UDAP, more robust revocation of modification requirements. And again, like the no action letter, there will be a publication. There can be a publication of denial of the application. So something to think about. Next slide. So, as I explained, the no action letter is an ability to reduce your regulatory burden under supervision and enforcement. But under a sandbox, there's some other types of relief. I want to point them out. They may not necessarily apply to the ARM industry. I want to make you aware of that. But however, that is, again, where comments may come in, because we may, you know, those in the industry may want to alert the Bureau that, you know, you're giving other statutes certain deference. You know, you haven't really talked about the FDCPA. I'm going to go over that in a few moments, but it's something that we should consider, but I want to walk you through this. So the types of relief under sandbox are this. First is approval. So under TILA, ECOA, and EFTA, Electronic Funds Transfer Act, embedded in the statute are safe harbor provisions. And so what the Bureau is saying is, if you want to do a sandbox, we will look to those statutes and we will give you those approvals under those particular safe harbor provisions. Now, we don't have any safe harbor provisions under the FDCPA. We have bona fide error under 1692KE. So again, the way the proposal is written, it is only referring to these three particular statutes that have safe harbors. It may be worth a comment to say, you know what, Bureau, what about bona fide error? Why can't we get some sort of approval under bona fide error? So something to think about. You can get no action relief similar to the same type of relief that you would see in a no action letter. Next slide. And the third type of relief. Next slide, Mike. And the third type of relief, sorry for the formatting there. The third type of relief is by exemption. Again, there are certain consumer financial protection statutes that have specific exemptions in them. So when I say here statutory provisions under exemption by order provisions, that is what I'm talking about. And those statutes are ECOA, the Homeowners and Equity Protection Act, and the Federal Deposit Insurance Act. They have specific exemptions. So if you're looking to do a sandbox, you would say to the Bureau, you know, if you're a lender, say, or if you're doing something in which are subject to these statutes, you would say to the Bureau, we want an exemption under that section of the statute. Again, the FDCPA does not have any specific exemptions. Again, it has bona fide error, but it doesn't have specific exemptions. But as I said before, maybe a good reason for a comment to say, you know, you should look at the FDCPA and you should give us those exemptions based on somewhat of a bona fide error. The other exemption would be just from what we call regulatory exemptions. So there is a regulation out there. Now, again, we don't have regulations yet under the FDCPA, but you would basically ask the Bureau for an exemption. There may be a regulation out there. We're just going to say to you, give us an exemption. Or we know what the statute says, but take a different position. And so that's a possibility. The exemption will include a statement that, you know, you have to act in good faith. The Bureau will deem whether you're in compliance with the conduct that you're doing, and they will give you a basis of why they're going to give you an exemption. Remember that, I'll get back to that in a second. So those are the three types of relief that you can ask for. And again, when you're thinking about, should I go to the Bureau? Do I want to get involved in any of these programs? You know, you're going to have to ask for the specific relief that you're looking for. So this just gives you a very crude idea of what those types of those areas of relief are. All right, next slide.
So let's start to sort of bring it all home here now. Joanne, let's talk about, you know, how this might or does or can apply everything that you've gone into so far to the ARM industry.
So I think that there are some really good opportunities here for the ARM industry. Look, industry has for a long time tried to think outside the box, but it's really hard to do that because of the liability that's involved, specifically the lack of regulation, but we know that's coming. But it's been really, really difficult. So I think what the Bureau has done is created some opportunities to experiment. And again, in consideration of maybe some data sharing and some partnership, there is some reduced regulation. And I can think of many, many opportunities within the debt collection process where folks can go to the Bureau and say, we want to try something. And these type of proposals would be helpful. Remember that we have an NPR coming in the next 90 days, supposedly. The no action letter may be a really good opportunity to test some of those proposals. You know, for example, if the NPR came out and then had a model initial demand letter, for under 1692G, maybe you can test those to see if they actually work, or maybe based on the proposal that the Bureau has, do something a little different. Because maybe what the Bureau is proposing is not going to work. Maybe after all is said and done, their initial demand letter is not good. So I think that, again, really crude examples, but that might be a basis to do that. In particular for the no action letters, because they are limited in scope, and I talked about this before, it may be an opportunity to do some of these quick fixes, these weighted ways to do collection process better. And that could be an opportunity for some folks. The sandbox is a little broader. As I said, it requires a Bureau partnership. But especially for startups, I think the sandbox may be a really great opportunity, really helps startup to really give them exposure, shows them as an industry leader, but it also may be a safer path to market. That's always one of an issue with a startup company, especially in our industry. And more importantly, I mean, we all have been screaming for the debt collection industry to come into the 21st century. I mean, we are one of the last industries to incorporate email or text. And I know a lot of folks are doing it, but they're doing it so cautiously and certainly on a much smaller scale, except for a few companies that we obviously know of. But this may be a really great vehicle to incorporate technology and test technology out and do it the right way. Remember that the FDCPA is a proscriptive statute. It tells you what you can't do. I think these proposals really foster, again, thinking out of the box, thinking of different ways of doing things and different ways of using your debt collection processes. The consideration is working with the Bureau, but also some reduced liability and exposure.
With respect to the no action letter, do you think there's a higher degree of likelihood that an application would be approved if it comes from an association versus, say, a company?
I do not. I don't. Okay. I have no reason to think that at this moment because I don't think anyone has actually engaged the Bureau or done an application yet. But I do not. I think it depends on what the idea is. I think the Bureau absolutely wants to work with associations, but I would not discourage companies who have a good idea and is something that could be, really helpful and as I said again, solve a problem, should absolutely get in there and speak with the Bureau.
And what about collaborative efforts? Would you see two companies getting together, or a group of companies getting together for a no action letter application?
I don't know why not. Why you wouldn't? I think it depends. It depends. you know, as I said before, if there's a company that works with a particular vendor, I can definitely see those kind of collaborations, and you do, under the no action letter, have some protection. The vendor has some protection there as well. But, you know, it depends. There could be some really interesting partnerships, but that's all going to depend on the companies who are speaking with one another and whether that's a path that they want to go down. But I wouldn't necessarily discourage it.
Got it. All right. Well, despite the comprehensiveness of your presentation, there's still a lot of question marks out there. Maybe you want to walk us through, you know, what we still don't know.
Yeah, there are still a lot of wires. I mean, it all looks wonderful on paper, but I think you have to really sit back and think about how this is all going to work. So I think the biggest question that has been written about a lot and we need to think about is, will the other regulators buy in? So we know that the Bureau wants them to, but wanting them to and them actually doing it are two different things. Let me say two things. First, as far as on the federal side, many of the other financial services regulators, like the SEC, the OCC, the FDIC, are all looking at this. And in fact, the SEC, Security Exchange Commission, already has an Office of Innovation. So this is something that in the past year, regulators have been looking at and looking at carefully. I think part of it comes from the Trump administration. The Trump administration has been very vocal about decreasing regulatory burden. And if any of you have looked at the Treasury report that came out about 6 months ago, both for the depository and non-depository side, there is this proposal to embrace innovation and figure out how it's all going to work in the financial services regulatory environment. So it's certainly been a priority of the Trump administration. So on the federal level, I don't see other federal regulators, you know, saying, no, we're not going to deal with this. I think there's going to be a lot of collaboration. I think the wild card here is the states. You have many more states that don't agree with the Bureau's mission right now. And so while you might get a no action letter on the federal level, I don't know how that's going to necessarily work in a state, especially if you're in a state like California or New York or Massachusetts. They're going to feel that there's no preemption there, and you know their requirements are a lot stricter than maybe what be at the federal level. And because they're stricter, they have the opportunity to enforce. So I think we're going to have to see. I think it's going to depend on where the company is located, where they're doing their business, who their state regulator is. So I think that we need to pay special attention to that. And I am sure the state regulators, the AGs, will be commenting on these proposals, and those are the types of comments that they will be making. As I said before, the no action letter as proposed has an unlimited duration. I think the consumer advocates are going to have a problem with that. I think it's going to have some sort of limit. It's not going to be in perpetuity. So, you know, that's an issue that I think is a wild card, and I think there will be some decision about how long a no action letter, the enforcement period of a no action letter. You know, scope of data sharing is always something that a company needs to look at and look at very critically. You know, what does that all mean? How is that all going to work? So that is something in your analysis of whether you want to proceed down this path, you need to look at and look at carefully. And the balancing act between your proprietary, you know, sharing your proprietary information and working with the Bureau for the reduction of regulatory burden, that's a cost-benefit analysis that is unique to each company, and they need to think about that. We also need to think about the implications of a public denial. Do you want people to know that you applied and you were denied and the reasons why? That could be very critical for some companies, and again, that goes into the analysis. One final point I want to make is, and we're still kind of rolling this issue around, is there some administrative law implications in all of this? Because, for example, you know, we have an NPR coming out in about 90 days. The NPR is going to say, you know, in order to comply with the FDCPA, you have to do X, Y, and Z. As I said before, we may want to test some of those proposals. If we test those proposals and we find that those proposals don't work and the Bureau should change the regulation, there still needs to be notice and comment if the Bureau is going to make any changes. So we need to figure out, it's called logical outgrowth, and we need to figure out how will the outcomes of the no action letter in the sandbox affect the final rule? And I don't know how closely the Bureau is looking at this, and we're going to have some meetings with them in the next couple months and discuss it, but that's something that the folks on the phone need to think about as well. So, you know, how from an administrative law aspect this is all going to work. And I don't, at this point, I don't know the answer. It's just something that we're looking at right now. Okay, next slide. So I want to talk about the trial disclosure program. Next slide, Mike. So to add more confusion to all the density that I'm talking about here, the Bureau has had and was required to have under Dodd-Frank a trial disclosure program. Under Section 1023E, the Bureau was authorized to permit companies to conduct trial disclosure programs, in a very limited way. That policy was finalized in 2013. And the reason we really haven't heard much about it is because there was not a single program that was approved in the 5 years that the program was developed. Next slide. So the Bureau in September of last year proposed, like the no action letter in the sandbox, proposed a new trial disclosure program, or TDP. It was already published and comments have already concluded. And so we suspect that the final trial disclosure program will be announced, you know, very shortly. And the goals of that program, again, in the prior regime were too onerous. There was no protections, which is why nobody, you know, applied to do a trial disclosure program. Now we have a reduced application. We have a specific time frame. There's guidance regarding the testing of the program and procedures if you want to obviously do some extensions if the program is successful, and coordination for future programs offered by other regulators. So, I mean, they've kind of made it more robust, but I will say to you, like the sandbox, there has to be a commitment to data sharing. These are federal disclosures. So the Bureau wants to know whether these disclosures are going to work. So like the sandbox, this is going to be a partnership with the Bureau, but it could be very helpful. Next slide. You know, if a waiver is granted, you'll be exempt from what the current disclosures are. So obviously you'll be exempt from any supervision or enforcement for not doing, you know, what the current disclosures require you to do. But you have to continue to work with the Bureau to make sure that by using a new disclosure, you're not otherwise harming consumers or having an adverse impact on consumers, because if you are, the Bureau may want to revoke that waiver in whole or in part. The Bureau is going to require companies, again, there's going to be a partnership here. If there are changes that need to be made, the Bureau is going to want you to make those changes. The Bureau is going to want to know whether there's any complaints, whether there's an increase, say, in default rates, if it's a certain type of disclosure. All that information has to be constantly exchanged with the Bureau, because they want to make sure, obviously, that consumers are not harmed. The upside is that, as I said, there will be no supervision and enforcement. I cannot say that there will not be private rights of action. There's no waiver of that. However, working with the Bureau and having the Bureau approve, whether it be a no action letter or trial disclosure program, you know, if you should get sued, and unfortunately, you know, I can never stop lawsuits, but if you should get sued, boy, going into court, maybe on a motion to dismiss or throughout the pretrial process, to say, you know what, Judge, I'm working with the Bureau right now. We don't know whether there's been harm or not, but we're trying to improve this process, I think may go a long way. Is it going to win the day? I can't sit here and say that. But it certainly will be helpful in your defense. And it certainly will be helpful to determine what the proper disclosures are for future use, because if the Bureau were to implement that that disclosure, that becomes obviously a bar to a claim, both from the Bureau itself and from third parties. Next slide. So engaging the Bureau. Thrown a lot of stuff at you. Maybe you're thinking about, you know, maybe I would want to apply. Couple things to consider. First of all, I would not recommend to anybody on this call to just fill out an application tomorrow and you know, and think that's going to win the day. Absolutely not. The first step you need to do is get in and talk to the Bureau. And, you know, like you would be, you know, trying to get a loan from a bank, or you were pitching investors. You know, you're pitching an entity that you're going to do business with. So you've got to come in and you've got to have, you know, you've got to present your idea. You've got to show the pros and the cons. You've got to be able to answer all those questions. And you need to do that before you submit applications, because you need to talk about, you know, what's the time limit going to be? What's the data that you want if you're doing a sandbox? You know, what are the questions you're going to have 6 months in? And am I going to get all of a sudden told that I have to change the processes that I've proposed? You know, maybe you negotiate whether if you deny this, I don't want it published. So there's a lot of issues that you need to talk about with the Bureau before you submit that application. But I think one of the most important things is you want to come in to the Bureau, identify the problem, and more importantly, show why your product or service is the solution. That's really what the Bureau is looking for. And consider, you know, whether the data that you are, if it's an issue of data sharing, you know, whether you're comfortable sharing that data or how that data is going to be used. Maybe it's going to stay within the Bureau. We know recently there was an RFI on some of the Bureau's data collection. You may want to talk about, hey, Bureau, I'm willing to give you my data, but you can't give it to anybody else. So there's a lot of moving parts, and you need to think very critically about what you want your proposal to look like and how you want the Bureau to handle it. I'm going to stop there, Mike, just because I've thrown a lot at your group, and there may be questions. So
yeah, we've got a few questions.
That's fine.
Go ahead. Is there something you wanted to say first?
Oh, I just want to say, you know, if we can't get to all the questions, you have my phone number and email. Please feel free to email me. I'm happy to answer any questions after this webinar.
Got it. The first question actually comes from me, and I'm wondering if you could sort of maybe describe, you know, circumstances under which a company or somebody may want to file a no action letter application versus try the sandbox.
Yeah, that's a great question. And as I said before, I think a no action letter focuses on something very limited. It's a specific maybe process, or as I talked about before, quick fix. Something you want to do in an established process, but maybe you want to do it differently. That would be a no action letter. Sandbox is really, and again, remember, the sandbox is going to be a partnership with the Bureau. It's going to be something that maybe hasn't been done before on a more grander scale. So a new product launch, a new service launch, you know, whether it be a new company or existing company. So I would view a sandbox as being much broader. And remember, I think it's going to be a much longer term commitment, 2 years. I don't think no action is going to go on forever. That could go on for 2 years, but I think it's going to be very, very limited. So those are the things you need to weigh when considering which or both you may want to do with the Bureau.
Got it. Just a reminder, we do have a few questions in the queue, but if you do have a question for Joanne, now's the time to type it out in the Zoom webinar control panel and send it in. We do only have about 10 minutes left. Next question. I'm wondering about concerns with new ideas that you wouldn't want competitors to be able to copy. If you get in the sandbox, can anyone find out about what you were doing in the sandbox, whether it is a new product or maybe content to try? Sorry.
That's a really, really good question, because not only will denials be published, but acceptances will be published as well. So that is a very, very good question. I don't have the easy answer to that. I think you have to be careful about what you're doing. I don't think, you know, when the Bureau says, you know, we've approved this application, one of the things you may want to talk about is how's that approval going to be published? Because obviously you want it to be as vague as possible so people don't copy. And it could be, you know, we've approved a company that is going to do a new form of a letter. Well, that's pretty vague. I don't know what that new form of letter may be. And one of the other things you can potentially ask the Bureau is that no other companies who are doing what we're doing be allowed in the sandbox as well. Again, this is why you need to come, you need to meet with the Bureau first before you do an application. But that's a great question.
Okay. All right. Now I'm going to ask two questions. One, I'm going to plant a seed and let you think about it for a little bit while you're answering the other question, and we'll come back to it, and then I'll ask the next question. The seed is, are there any other specific examples other than the validation notice or the barcode that you mentioned before for the ARM industry that are good candidates for either the no action letter or the sandbox? Let's think about that one for a little bit. The next question is, at the end of a no action letter process, or your time is, you know, your time in the sandbox is up, are the lessons or the learnings of the applicant made public?
They could be. The proposal doesn't say, what was published in the Federal Registry doesn't make any doesn't indicate whether it will or will not. But I think one of the things, the outcomes that you would want from a no action letter is ultimately a rule. And so if the no action letter is successful, if the experiment is successful, then it's really to go to the, you know, say to the Bureau, okay, this works. Now this becomes the industry standard, and the Bureau either writes a rule or guidance in which others are to follow.
Okay, makes sense.
To answer your first question, I want to be very careful about this. But as I said before, you know, technology. I mean, we have, as an industry, been very slow to incorporate technology. You know, the first ideas out of my head, trying to be as nonspecific as possible, is, you know, how do we incorporate email, text, and other ways of communicating with consumers? That's been the biggest challenge for our industry in decades. So a no action letter, even a sandbox, may provide some companies with ideas to test new ways to reach consumers.
Got it. That makes sense. Next question. Would the CFPB consider granting a preliminary no action letter for a limited period of time, and then if the innovation proves useful, grant a final unlimited no action letter?
Well, as I said before, I think the goal of a no action letter is to convince the Bureau that there should be a rule, or if that's the best practice that others in the industry can follow. So I don't know that they can break it up that way, but I think, as I said, the goal is to try to do what you're doing and make that the standard so that if others follow it, there will be no risk or liability.
Okay, got it. Moving on, next question. So let's say, hypothetically, a company is located in California, but gets into the CFPB sandbox, and then you only offer the new product or service to consumers in quote-unquote safe states. Would you still be subject to a problem with the state regulators or the Attorney General's office in California, because you're located in California, even though you aren't working with California consumers?
A little bit of a confusing question. My first response would be no, because I don't know whether a California AG would have jurisdiction. The fact that you're doing business in a state doesn't necessarily mean, from an AG's, from a consumer protection standpoint, an AG of that state can bring an action if you're not harming any consumers in that state. I mean, it's a good question, and it's an issue, as we talked about before, is whether the state regulators are going to buy into this. And that may be a difficulty. But it's a good idea. The person who raised this question is, if you're not in a good state, is to, you know, again, this is not on these applications and these ideas that you have are limited in scope. They're not very broad based. So maybe to limit it to a state where there is a more favorable AG might be an excellent idea, even though you may be located in a state like California.
Got it. Well, those are the only questions we have right now in the queue. I don't know if you wanted to maybe summarize for a minute, you know, sort of kind of recap what you've talked about and give it, oh wait, one more question has come in. Hold on, let me see when we get to it here. Do you expect the upcoming rule proposal to address communicating with consumers through email? Look into your crystal ball.
Not specifically. I think what's interesting in my discussions with the Office of Innovation and with others at the Bureau is they're looking at this very broad base, not specifically to debt collection. I think quite honestly, they're thinking about this more on the lending side and maybe even in the mortgage side. So I don't think they're looking at debt collection, which I will tell you, that's not a bad thing, because that we can go to the Bureau and say, you should be thinking about debt collection, and here's ways that we can implement these proposals to help debt collection. I think the Bureau is going to be very interested in that. So I don't think it's more, I think these proposals are not market specific. It's our job, your job, applicant's job, to go to the Bureau and say why your proposal is specific to a particular market. I hope that makes sense.
Yep. All right. Okay. Now there are no more questions. So now maybe we'll take a second and wrap things up.
Okay. Well, again, thank you, Mike, very much for allowing me this opportunity. And thank you all on the call for listening. This is, as I said, pretty dense. As most things are written by federal regulators, not the easiest thing in the world to understand. I hope that I've given you some idea of how, of the intention of this and how it could potentially work. We are still in the proposal stage. As I said, there's notice and comments for the no action letter and sandbox. So comments will be coming in, and then there'll be a final policy. Will it look different than what we have right now? It could be. As I talked about, I think there'll be some changes as to the time limit. But I think, again, it's the beginning of at least a federal agency willing to tackle innovation, which I think is so critical for our industry. And I really would encourage all of you to think about ways that you may want to get involved with this. And as I said, you're not bound by an application. You may go meet with the Bureau and decide this is not for you. That's fine. But really would hope that folks would consider opportunities to work. It's always good to have a good relationship with your regulator. To educate them, especially in our industry where we've always felt that regulators don't have a clear understanding of what we do. So I would encourage all of you to think about this more, ask questions, and let's see how this all pans out.
Excellent. Well, on behalf of everybody listening, Joanne, thank you. To those who are still on the call, I wanted to point out this webinar was Joanne's idea because she knew the implications for the RM industry were pretty substantial, and she wanted to get this out in front of you. So I think we all owe her a big thank you for taking the time to so thoroughly go through this topic. Thank you very much, Joanne. Thanks to everybody who participated. Thanks and asked questions. And Joanne, I'm sure we'll be back within hopefully 90 days within your timeline to talk about the proposed debt collection rule.
Yes. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, thanks, everybody. Enjoy the rest of your day. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.